The microbes of the university keep trying to kill me, but they can't. This is Punk News Podcast 387. Welcome to the Punk News Podcast. My name is Adam White, recording for you here in my basement in Niagara Falls, Ontario, in a room that is full of children's toys that are going to distract me throughout this entire show because they're just so fun to play with. This has been a weird week. I've been ill and then not ill and then iller and then not in a cool way. Because I have children that, while they leave all these toys in my personal little podcasting studio here, they're all covered in secret germs, and it's just generally horrible. So joining me from a safe distance away, where none of my microbes can get them out of parts withheld, USA, on a cell phone, Mr. John Gentile.
You know, I'm selling on the cell phone, baby. In a cell, selling on the cell.
There is a billboard in Welland, which is the town near here, where there's the local real estate guy. His face is on the billboard, and I forget what the name of the guy is, but it says like, "Call Bill's quote sell quote phone," but they wrote it with an S, John, because he's gonna sell your fucking house. It's been there my entire life, and I feel that at some point someone must have had an intervention with this guy and been like, that's neither clever nor so stupid that it's ironically clever, like, take that down. And this guy's just dug in and been like, fuck you, man, I sell houses despite that billboard, and it just remains.
Adam, I've caught you in a lie. It can't possibly have been there during your entire life, because cell phones were only invented in like 1988, 1989.
Yeah.
Oh, shit, I'm a fraud. All right, it's been there for as long as I can remember.
Adam resigned from Punk News based off that.
Yeah, I just delete my Facebook profile and everything and vanish. At least, though, if I did that, I'd be the one person that has some integrity, right? Everyone else, they're lying, and they're lying to cover up their lies. I should just leave. Joining me also on the show, who hasn't been on the show in a while, where it hasn't been like a Christmas episode or some other weird game of grab ass that we set up every once in a while. It's Mr. Greg Simpson. Hey, Greg.
Hey, yeah, I miss podcasting. You know, Best Midwestern's been on a hiatus for like a good chunk of 2017, that apparently that ska tournament took just a lot out of us or something, but we're coming back with a vengeance. We've got a year-long plan for it that I will not reveal at this point, but I've been producing all these podcasts and not really been on them, so I wanted to get a little refresher in before Best Midwestern starts back up next month.
The great thing that no one knows is that Greg provides us with feedback to things that we say on the episodes before anyone hears the episodes. So we'll get random comments from Greg during the editing, responding to things that we've said. And then I won't bother to actually release it to the public for like a week and a half after that. And it's a weird feedback buffer that we've created for ourselves.
So, it's like live tweeting, but none of it is live and only you guys get to see it.
Yeah, so it's not useful to the rest of the world, but it's amusing to me.
I like your questions and your queries.
You're pointing out like the things that I've said that are wrong. Speaking of the things that we've said that are wrong. We have lots of mail, John, don't we?
Yeah, we do. Honestly, it's my favorite kind of mail week because we have some letters that unbeknownst to each other are directly in conflict. So let's just jump right into it. You can reach us at podcast@punknews.org. This is from Nathaniel, and here's what Nathaniel has to say. Hi, podcast. On your New Year's episode, you talked about ways you might improve the show, be it upping the production or trying out a different structure. Here's a suggestion from someone who eagerly awaits each new episode. Post the damn thing on time. In episode 384, you mentioned you were recording on January the 3rd, but it didn't show up in my feed until the 14th of January. Then 4 days later, episode 385 was posted. I know this podcast is a labor of love from a group of volunteers, but this drives me bananas. If you're going to miss a week, you should announce it ahead of time. Otherwise, you should choose the day of the week to publish episodes and to stick to it. Also, about the new Jeff Rosenstock record, your discussion was practically a verbatim reenactment of the episode on his last record, Worry, when that album came out. John had a few small critiques, but overall was enthusiastically on board. Ricky voiced some support for Jeff's old material, but as per usual, when presented with truly great music, he didn't seem to have engaged with the material in any kind of meaningful way, and gave a bland, beige-colored, ho-hum kind of no response that can be summed up in three words. Over my head. And Adam gave a long, vaguely anti-millennial monologue about how he's living too traditional a lifestyle and is too old and too privileged to truly connect with the context of Jeff's work. I felt like I was having deja vu. Bully on my man, Johnny G, for being on the right side of history. But Ricky and Adam need to sit with J-Rose work a lot more before talking about it on the podcast, especially Adam, who up until that time hadn't even listened to the record yet. Keep up the great work, and I look forward to next week's episode, which will probably be posted in March.
Oh, fuck off, you guy, whatever your name is. It's Adam's fault. That's what I meant to say.
It's generally my fault.
It's both of our faults.
No, but I mean, it's mostly mine.
I'm late on the one.
If anything, I think that the fact that two Jeff records came out and we responded to both of them with consistent responses without that being the plan, that looks good on us, I think.
Consistency.
Or did it show that we don't move and we're unchanging?
No, I don't think that because, I mean, between those two records, Mr. Rosenstock didn't do anything that's going to dramatically change your mind if you weren't into his thing in the first place, which is not meant to be an insult on him. It's just like they're two chapters in the overall thing that he's putting out, right? So that
true
that fits, right? But if I were to have had a completely different reaction to his one thing and then a completely different reaction to the other one, I might sound more like I'm talking out of my ass. So I'm totally fine with having my millennial side eye view on both. I like Jeff Rosenstock though.
Isn't,
I like those records.
Isn't he only like 4 or 5 years younger than us? We're all kind of around.
No,
the same
I don't
age,
think
right?
He's much younger than us at all. I think he might be like maybe a year or two or something.
He's
like that.
Actually, he's the exact age of all three of us.
So what was the
he just
millennial
lives in
rant?
The hip, youthful world, and
it keeps him young.
Yeah,
all that skanking.
But I think if we can agree with anything from that letter, it's fuck Ricky, right?
Yeah. A beige response.
Oh, Ricky, I'm so sorry.
This is from Camillo, and here's what Camillo has to say. Both the Menzingers and Jeff Rosenstock records perfectly capture the millennial state of mind. The Menzingers are for when you want to feel sad about being happy, and Jeff Rosenstock is for when you want to feel happy about being sad, from Camillo.
Ooh. I like that.
There was a Hard Times article that came out the other day that was wildly shared where, and John, I'm surprised I didn't see you react to this, where it was basically like the Menzingers write next album about coaching Little League. And they went and they like did up cover art and everything for it and made up song titles. And it was just like this nostalgic aging punk's view on, you know, regretfully becoming an adult and having to coach Little League. And it was all of your... your singer's criticisms wrapped up beautifully.
You know, can I share a story related to coaching musicians coaching Little League? This is just a random thing. Okay, so Davey Von Bullen from The Promise Ring and Captain Jazz. He lives in the Milwaukee, Wisconsin area, as do my in-laws. And my brother-in-law coaches basketball with him. They coach youth basketball together. And so, like, Davey was on Best Midwestern, and we talked about this, and, you know, he's a dad and all that cool stuff. And I was just emailing him. We chat just rarely, you know, we're not like chummy or anything, but it's like, oh yeah, so what are you working on now? You know, new maritime record or whatever. It's like, I don't know. I'm just coaching so much. I don't know if there's any more music happening. I don't know if I'm even in a band anymore. And I was ready to go hang myself in a closet. I was like, no, put your kids.
Coaching is a hell of a drug. You can totally get into this like weird subculture of dad coach.
Yeah, apparently he has.
So I don't know.
I was trying to get him to guest on the Outdoor Velour record, actually. I was like, dude, what do you think? He's like, I don't know, man. I haven't sung in so long. I'm like, God,
you can be like,
it,
you have
Davey.
Nothing left to lose.
I'm like, now's the time to reemerge on the scene on my unknown band's record. That made me sad. So that just sounded like that Hard Times article just went right into that. Sounds like he needs to write an album. The next Maritime album will be about coaching youth basketball.
John, do I rag on millennials too much?
No, I think you rag on them not enough. I think they need to be. Listen, I got to say, man, millennials do kind of infuriate me on many levels. But is that just because I'm being an old man, or are they really obnoxious people? One of the things that annoys me, two of the things that really do annoy me about millennials is, first of all, they have no sense of patience. Like, they'll literally email me at like 10 a.m. and say, John, have you had a chance to do X, Y, Z? And they'll email me again at like 2 p.m. And I'm like, son, it's been 4 hours. I'm a grown man with a job. I don't have time to worry about whether or not your band's, you know, issued a remastered release of an album they put out 2 months ago or not. You know what I mean? a second is the other thing that annoys me is, and honestly, maybe this is a virtue, I don't appreciate it. Millennials really don't have, I guess, the deference to authority or seniority that people our age and older do have. Like, my one friend, his wife is pretty high up at her job, but she works with a lot of millennials who are just getting started in that field. And it's a pretty boring field. It's something to do with like wills and trusts. It's a very boring field. And basically, her gripe, and honestly, I think she might be a little bit too much of a hard ass, but her gripe is that the 22, the 23, the 24-year-olds is they feel as though their input is equally as valid as someone that's like 34, 35, been doing it for 10 years, or even 45 or 55. And I don't know if that's a virtue or what's the opposite of a virtue? Like a deficit, but that's not the word. Like, is it good that they don't like have, you know, because maybe they really do know better? Or do they fail to realize that some people have been doing things for a long time or for a little while have a better understanding of how a certain thing works than people who just got started?
I don't know. Like, you could say that, you could paint that as a positive and say it's like, you know, it's gumption, right? They're...
Well, actually, he's a great example. So I've been freelance writing for, I guess, almost 10 years now. And whenever I write a letter, I write it very respectfully, you know, and if the editor or somebody doesn't like, then I'll shoot them an email and say, oh, Jill, you know, thanks for working on this with me. I really appreciate it. I wonder if we could do something about X, Y, Z, maybe blah, blah, blah. Millennials will just shoot, say, you know, you're wrong or this is stupid or something like that, which like I guess the lack of dear Mr. So-and-so from millennials does annoy me a great deal. But is that just because they have no manners, or is that just how culture is now? Is culture crasser than it used to be? I kind of think it is. I don't know. Maybe I'm just being an old man.
That's how everyone emails you.
Generalizing quite a bit here.
Let me go listen to my Rush records in peace. Leave me alone.
No, all right. I mean, I want to preface all this by just saying that, like, I almost I complain about millennials almost out of some sort of defiance to the fact that I think that by most definitions, like, I am one. Like, I was born in 82, which most people's counts is millennial, but
I disagree. I define millennial as someone who has never been, you know, generally aware and not had the internet. I do think there's a significant difference in people who were aware at a time before the internet and people that basically became aware only when there was the internet.
I like that. Yeah. So I was 81 and most of the stuff I see like ends right at 81 or 82. Like some I've seen would get you in Gen X, Adam.
Well, there was some study that was published not too long ago where they said like there's actually some sort of middle generation that they were calling Xennials, which was really like where it was the exact definition that John just barked out, and it took a bunch of social scientists to make it up, where basically they were saying that like if they had like an analog childhood but like a digital, they came into like digital fluency in their teens, yeah, as opposed to like growing up fully in the digital universe, right? Like that was the difference. Or if you're in this like weird between generation. But I don't know, like I tend to jokingly complain about millennials more because
it's fun.
It's fun. And I mean let's just say it here. Like it's mostly good fun while we're making fun of them, because you know, when we all want to sit down and really look at it, like the baby boomers are the worst generation ever, right?
Oh yeah.
So there's it ruined everything. It's like millennials haven't done half that bad shit ever. Like
not yet.
Just annoying.
Yeah.
I don't know if I can agree with that. I don't think you could say I think most baby boomers are pretty good people. I think there are a few exceptionally bad people that have caused a lot of problems.
Ricky. I think that their generation John. And its like selfishness totally fucked the universe. So I'm down with them being the worst generation ever.
See, but I find your average baby boomer to not be selfish, and your average millennial to be selfish. But listen, speaking of baby boomers, here's a letter.
Can we piss off any swaths of people on this show that we haven't yet? Get to the next letter, John.
Well, speaking of baby boomers, this is from Liverpool Neil, who writes in to chastise us. Hi, guys. Liverpool Neil here. Rant coming. I love you guys, but episode 384 was not one of your better ones. Normally, I burn through a single episode in one sitting, but damn, I found it really hard to get through this episode at all. Maybe it's me, and maybe I'm getting too old. Let's see what you guys did on episode 384. John babbled about Alice Cooper again. John babbled about Run the Jewels again. Ricky babbled about some Canadian band who make awful half-assed commercial jingles. Half an hour of you guys gushing over Jeff Rosenstock like he's the equivalent of Joe Strummer or Joey or Jello. Half an hour of you guys talking about the Menzingers, who, let's face it, are average on their best day. If punk is a rainbow of different sounds and feelings, the Menzingers are beige. The letters and songs you guys played were the best part of the show. So I guess my question is, am I just being more grumpy than usual, or am I accurate and that was a particularly slow news week? Love you all. Stay free from Liverpool Neil.
Another beige insults. Wow.
Interesting, right? And they all talk, and all three talk about the Menzingers and Jeff Rosenstock.
Well, I wasn't on that episode, so I just mixed it.
Yeah, so if anything, it was the audio fidelity of the episode that you really have a complaint about. It just was not capturing you. oh, God, I don't know. I mean, it's... All right, here's the thing. First, Neil, I'm going to agree with you on this. I'm so fucking tired of talking about that Jingles band and their jingles. It's not interesting anymore. But they weren't Canadian, by the way. Also, I don't know. It's sort of a... This is a weird time of year news-wise. Normally, there isn't a whole ton that's going on between, you know, just before Christmas and, like, the middle of January for, like, a whole bunch of industry reasons. And that week, like, the Rosenstock record was, like, the one kind of surprise that popped up, I guess. But in any case, it's still sort of a weird thing to discuss in an engaging way because it's like, oh, fuck, this record just came out. Everyone have an opinion on it. And it's like, well... Hold on. Not everyone's even been able to sit down and digest this. So, yeah, I don't know. This week, though, kind of like disproves that, though, because a lot of shit happened this week. So, I don't know. This week might be more to your liking, Liverpool Neil.
Let's make it beige, just for him.
Well, as always, you can reach that podcast at punknews.org. This past weekend, actually on Sunday night, I went and saw Lee Scratch Perry. Adam and Greg, who is Mr. Lee Scratch Perry?
I swear legendary. To God, it sounded like you said Lou Scratch Perry.
Lou Vega.
I'm like, that's not the real one, John. You got
He's the
off.
Mambo number five guy, right? A little bit of Monica, right? Lou Scratch Vega.
Oh God, that was, we should cut that. That was a bad, stupid joke.
No,
so
I'll keep it. So I decide.
John, have you seen Scratch before?
I've seen Scratch, and actually, this is interesting. Is I'm in a Lee Scratch Perry fan. Well, it's actually not a Lee Scratch Perry fan club on Facebook, but it's a reggae club that evolved out of a Lee Scratch Perry fan club. And they haven't seen him, where they saw him like once in 1999. I've seen him four. I thought everybody had seen him a whole bunch of times, but none of them had seen him or like once. I've seen him four times before.
I don't know. You're the pro, John. So what? Tell us about seeing him. I've not yet seen him. I feel like he is just not. I've not been in like the same time and place as the Lee Scratch Perry show in a while.
Well, listen, he's 81, Adam. So you better get on that.
You know what? That is not a good thing, because whenever I've had that thought, someone dies. So we should really not try to base. You know, should Adam go see this potentially is going to die artist, because that's bad.
Well, it was last year I wanted to go see him, but it was the same night as Morrissey. I'm like, damn, should I see Lee Scratch Perry or Morrissey? I'm a bigger fan of Lee Scratch Perry, but I had never seen Morrissey before, and so I chanced it, and I felt bad for a year because I picked Morrissey over Lee Scratch. I'm a big fan of both, but Perry is the man, so I was so happy I got to see him, and basically on the same tour, even though it's a year later. Lee Scratch Perry is basically as important as it gets in regards to music. He's a extremely influential producer who invented reggae or took extremely big steps in the reggae field. He almost certainly invented dub along with King Tubby. And basically, he almost certainly did invent the concept of remix. On top of that, is he's recorded hundreds of awesome, awesome songs. And he's just an amazing person. He's 81. On Sunday night, I drove down the Baltimore scene with a group called Subatomic Sound System. That's basically just a DJ. It's a guy called EMCH, and he plays kind of electronic meets dubstep meets reggae. I think I don't know how, if you were in a dance music, you could probably describe it, but I would call it electronic dub is what I would call it. And they were doing all of the seminal album Super Ape, which is unusual because Perry produced that album and he doesn't really sing on it. But he doesn't really produce anymore. So basically, they built the whole album from the ground up again and basically made an electronic version of that album. And Perry sang on it on a new CD. And actually, it's a pretty cool CD. So for the show, it started at like 8 o'clock. I'm like, great, I'll get out by like 12. It'll be Subatomic didn't even start till 9, and they did it like a 45-minute warm-up, if you will. But it was pretty cool. It was the guy EMCH on the turntables, famous drummer Larry McDonald on percussion. Larry McDonald is a guy that drummed for Peter Tosh and a whole bunch of other people. Who else was there? A saxophone player was there. And right before Perry came out, this beautiful girl comes out, and she's got literally a tray of fruit that's on fire, and she puts it down, and then she goes back and starts singing. And Perry comes out, and this is burning fruit in front of him. And at 81, he performed for 2 hours and 15 minutes. They did all of Super Ape. They did maybe my favorite song ever, Disco Devil. And basically, he just like yells and sings and stuff like during the songs. At one point, I think he thought that someone like stole something backstage, and he got really mad, and he started cursing about how much he like hates thieves and liars and stuff. But he speaks with such a heavy patois, like the audience didn't understand what he was saying, and they were like cheering. They're like, yeah, me. Meanwhile, he's going like, you know, at mother effing thieves, I hate mother effing thieves, I'm gonna leave, I quit, I'm out of here. But he's saying it in Jamaican slang, of course. And so they don't even realize it. And I'm like, he's pretty pissed off, people. So he goes off stage, but somebody convinced him to come back on. And he did about six or seven more songs. They did one of the baddest ass versions of I Am a Madman I've ever heard. It was so loud, the room was shaking. And Perry, he's 81. He doesn't look like he's 81. He looks like he's about maybe 50. Like, you know when people get really old, like their skin gets like really thin and kind of see-through, and their hands get gnarled and their face gets all wrinkly? Perry's hands look like a younger person's hands. His face, I mean, he doesn't look like he's 20, but he doesn't look like he's 81. Like he isn't, and he's doing like high kicks, he's jumping and he's dancing. At 81, it's insane. And so it's Like I always say, go see the Legends while you have the chance. And it was so thrilling to see him. One thing I did want to bring up, though, is the backup singer girl. She was very good looking. But here's the question. Is it appropriate for me to even comment on if she was really good looking or not? And here's why. She was dressed in a way that to look beautiful. She had on yoga pants and she had on basically like not a bikini top, but just a little bit more than a bikini top, if you will. And so you could tell that she wanted to look like sharp, you know, and I'm like, damn, that girl's like amazingly good looking. And beyond that, even beyond the sexual part, like just from a pure aesthetic, it was like really interesting to see this beautiful person up there. Like when I saw Nick Turner, when he had two gorgeous girls on either side of him, both playing keyboards and both playing electronic violins. And I've said before, where do you find two extremely good looking women that are really into Hawkwind that can both play the keyboard and the electronic violin? Like only Nick Turner could do that.
Yeah,
and it was such a neat aesthetic to have like Nick Turner, this grizzled old guy singing about flying through space, and these two gorgeous women on either side of him. But if a kid turned in like a review, if anybody turned in a review, say like bad cop, and said, oh, you know, bad cop, they're so good looking, you know, I would cut that line right out. I'd be like, that, you know, that's inappropriate for this kind of review. But is it appropriate for me to talk about the girl Lee Scratch Perry or the two girls and Nick Turner were like super hot, you know, like, can I say, is that rude when it appears to me that she was trying to dress in a way to accentuate her attractiveness, if you will?
I mean, as long as you don't say it on your podcast, you're
pretty.
Okay.
Adam, what do I do here? I cut that out.
It's not an insult to say a woman is good looking, you know, but the problem is you are saying they're good looking, but that's all they're worth, or they're good looking, so nothing else is relevant. That's not what I'm saying. She was a wonderful singer, but she was also strikingly beautiful.
I think it's a contest. Sorry, Greg, I couldn't do there. Do you want to?
Oh, I was just saying he prefaced all that with a whole rant about how beautiful Lee Scratch Perry's baby-like hands were. Yeah, the hands of an infant.
I think that like it all depends on, I think, like the context in which you're having that discussion. I think it's fine to acknowledge if someone is beautiful, in particular if they're a performer and they're, you know, them choosing to dress and look in a certain way in front of an audience was clearly a conscious choice. Right. But on the other hand, if you're approaching it from a, you know, I'm going to review the music that happened here, then that detail's pretty inconsequential. If you're going to approach it from a, you know, I just want to shoot the shit about my evening and here are the things that I observed, then, you know, it's, I don't think it's exploitative or anything like that for you to have that as part of the conversation. I mean, certainly, John, you've phrased it in a way that I think is pretty tame compared to what some people would. So,
yeah,
you know, just don't say it on your podcast. That's all.
Yeah. Fair enough.
Anyone can respond to the thing that you've said by emailing podcast@punknews.org,
I think Kayla is going to write in. It'll be like the first time she listens to the podcast ever. And she's going to write in and she's going to have something to say about it. I can guarantee that, John.
I don't care. That person's rotten. I don't care.
She doesn't listen.
All right. So anyways, John, are you doing all this to lead into a Lee Scratch Perry song to open up the show?
I was going to, but let's do it. I'm going to pick one of the songs from his new record. It's called The Super Ape Returns. It's a new version of the classic Super Ape album with Lee Scratch Perry recording. Most of Lee Perry's songs don't sound like this. This is kind of a unique project, but let's check it out. It's out right now via MVD Music.
Underground.
We're back. John, was that song 45 minutes long?
No, that song is about 3 minutes long, I think.
Oh, really? Okay, I was just guessing. So, all right, we got a bunch of stories that we want to talk about. Things actually happened this week, which is rare for January, so we'll talk about a bunch of them. First of all, The Damned have premiered a new single from their new album. The single is called Standing on the Edge of Tomorrow, and you can hear it over at the Spotify service if you're so inclined. There's a link on Punk News if you want to find your way to that. The new LP this is going to be on is called Evil Spirits. It was produced by Tony Visconti. It's out on April 13th on the Search and Destroy and Spine Farm Records label. John, what do we want to talk about here? I guess we should try to, I guess, contextualize this a little bit. So first of all, let's talk about who's producing this thing here. I think we mentioned this on the last show, but Tony Visconti. Let's remind people who that is.
Tony Visconti is one of the world's most famous producers ever, and one of the greatest. You were just talking about Lee Scratch Perry, who's the greatest. Visconti is one of the greatest. Visconti has produced many, many, many very famous records, namely T-Rex, and then quite famously, Bowie either borrowed, stole, or took Visconti from T-Rex to Bowie, then Bowie became super famous. Visconti produced all of Bowie's mega hits records, Ziggy Stardust, Station to Station, Diamond Dogs, Low, all those hits, Tony Visconti. He's an amazing producer. He's also produced a Morrissey record. He's produced Thin Lizzy and a whole bunch of other stuff. And of course, the reason the Damned pick him is the Damned are huge fans of psychedelic and glam rock. And who's Mr. Psychedelic and Glam Rock? Tony Visconti. He's the guy that straddles both those worlds, and he's the guy that kind of created or was extremely important in creating both of those genres. Well, not psychedelic rock, but you know, glam.
Yeah. So now also let's just we'll give, I guess, a little bit of details on where this kind of sits as far as the Damned catalog, because since 1986 or so, we're on a, you know, for the most part, it seems like there's a huge stretch between everything this band does. So the Damned was releasing stuff pretty regularly up through like the mid 80s. And then after Anything in 86, you jumped, you know, it was like 9 years to Not on This Earth in 1995. Grave Disorder came out in 2001. So Who's Paranoid in 2008? And I think that's it, right?
That's it.
Has there been anything between this and that? So I mean, the Damned keep on chugging, but there are stretches between these records that they've been putting out. So a particularly, you know, long one, almost 10 years, I guess, between So Who's Paranoid and this one. So so first of all, like, what's everyone think of this?
Go ahead, Greg. I've been talking a lot.
I thought it was good. The production is excellent, and the song was very, I mean, it's very Damned. It's very spooky but catchy. I only had a chance to listen to it twice, but I'm digging it. You know, if the album's like that, bring it on.
I definitely dug the track. I wasn't blown out of my seat, but I definitely thought it was a solid, good Damned track. One thing that basically all later day Damned tunes seem to inhabit is they all do have that kind of goth, garage rock, early Pink Floydian vibe. And what's interesting is the Damned have always said, you know, we created punk along with the Sex Pistols and the Clash, but we never get credit. But then the Damned also go on to basically purposely distance themselves from punk, and they kind of purposely don't record super bangers like you heard on the first Damned album, or even the harder stuff on Machine Gun Etiquette, which I guess is pretty punk in of itself. But it definitely feels as though this is the kind of track that the Damned want to record because they are fans of this music and they grew up listening to this music. So it's a good track, not super surprising, but a lot of later day Damned albums are uneven. There's some amazing tracks on them, and some tracks are just kind of boring. It does feel as though Tony Visconti will help them make all tracks be good or very good on this album, and we might get the most solid album we've had since Phantasmagorium, or maybe even since Strawberries, or even the Black Album.
Ooh. Yeah, I'm a fan of this track. Like, there's some, you know, some pretty heavily, like, I mean, like, you mentioned the early garage rock thing, and that's true, but like the other thing that really shines through on this is just like that sort of like 80s goth, like, just like the,
yeah,
like there's a, I'm, unless I'm making this up because I listened to it earlier today, but like there is that kind of like keyboard shimmer over this whole thing, and it's just from a pop song standpoint, it feels pretty solid to me. Like, it feels pretty good. The chorus has been stuck in my head for hours.
Right.
So
yeah.
So I'm into this. I have not paid too much attention to what the Damned have done in like, I don't know, like in the past 20 years, I guess, for whatever reason. Like, I'm, you know, like all good 90s kids that got into punk, I, you know, went back and did my homework and listened to my early Damn records, you know, and I like that stuff, but I wasn't super aware of the stuff that they were doing after that. But this track in particular sort of makes me want to go back and start revisiting some of it, because I'm like, am I missing a bunch of stuff that I would have really liked, because I like this a lot. So there you go. There's a Damn stuff coming.
I mean, a Black Album is an amazing album. A lot of people say it's their favorite Damned album. I might agree. I saw them do that live. It is amazing. Strawberries is an excellent album. Phantasmagorium is that's a straight-up goth album. The ones after that are okay. Two interesting things to point out. Paul Gray plays bass on this. Paul Gray, of course, is joining the band after like a 30-year absence. He played bass on the Black Album, and he's considered one of the better bass players of the Damned, or the best, depending on who you ask. Second thing is, this isn't necessarily relevant to this album, but I learned an interesting factoid a couple of weeks ago. While reading up on this record, I looked back on their last album, So Who's Paranoid? That's really a Captain Sensible solo album. Every track on that album was written by Captain Sensible, whereas every single other Damned album, it's been a group effort or a song here or there. So it seems that So Who's Paranoid was really a Captain Sensible solo album, and they wanted to do a Damned album. And listening to that album, you can really tell it's very much more in the garage rock psychedelic vein, where this has got a heavier goth slant, which suggests a much heavier Dave Vanian influence.
Yeah, it'll be cool to see what this sucker sounds like. So let's jump on to the next one here. Greg, I need to pick your brain about some of this story here. Because I don't actually know how the world works, but anyways, so I mean, I don't really know how thievery works, and you would really be the best one to explain to me.
I'm a good burglar. So
it has been a year of ups and downs for the band Jawbreaker. In the second half of 2017, the band, of course, reunited to much fanfare. However, there have been some California cat burglars. Do we know they're cat burglars? What makes you a cat burglar? They were not too interested in seeing the band live. So sometime between the end of 2017 and the beginning of this year, the aforementioned burglars, they broke into Jawbreaker's California storage unit and stole a bunch of stuff. They took an amplifier, snare drums, and external hard drives that were containing the band's digitized masters. So you can find, if you search for it on Punk News, you can see kind of like the full list of the stuff that they took, including the you know, the models and the years of all that of all those instruments. If you see them in a you know, in a pawn shop or anything near you, Greg, where I wanted to ask you here was, mm-hmm. when they say they stole a bunch of hard drives that had the band's digitized masters on them.
Mm-hmm. They've got to be somewhere else. I mean, they're...
That's what I was, because the way that this was all described, the band didn't seem ultra panicky or anything like that. I mean, I don't know how you would sound panicky in words written on the internet. It wasn't all in caps. All caps. Right? but it's not like, oh no, someone has made off with the only copy of Unfun.
Okay, yeah, if someone made off with, like, the reels, like, I'm assuming... most of their stuff was recorded analog, if not all. I mean, maybe Dear You is digital, I'm not sure. But if someone made off with the reels, the original reels, like, that would be a big problem. But those reels are still somewhere, you know? So even if they needed to re-digitize it, you've still got the original, you know, analog recording. And when you digitize something as important as an album you're going to release, you know, it's a big fucking deal. It's on these external hard drives, but it's probably on a computer somewhere, right? Like at the studio or somewhere. There's got to be at least two, if not more, copies. Like at least one analog, you know, the reels, the copy, and then another digital copy somewhere. Maybe they're just concerned about someone like trying to make a profit off of this somehow. I don't.
Yeah, I mean, like, you don't want that shit out in the wild. But I mean, like, I'm just trying to, like Blake's not going to have to go try to, like, grab their music off of LimeWire the next time they want to make something, right?
I wouldn't think so. I mean, it's not like when you digitize the masters off some, like, you know, I just got the 50th anniversary remaster, big box set of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. They didn't go and burn the reels right after they did the new digitized master. I mean, come on.
Hey, Greg, what'd you think of that version of that album?
Oh, it's fucking amazing.
See, I didn't like it. I thought it sounded too sterile to me. Like everything was so separated. It felt like it's there's much more clarity on it. But because everything was so separated, it felt like it had much less of an impact, or it sounded less epic to me.
Hmm. To me, it made me notice things in the arrangements that I had never noticed. And it's an album that I've listened to my whole life. Well, let me ask you this, John. When... like a lot of albums, when they've re-released them, even if it's on like one CD or something, it'll be like, here's the full album in mono. Here's the full album in stereo. Which one do you listen to?
Both.
Okay. You don't have a preference?
No. I mean, some albums have better mono mixes. Some albums have better stereo mixes. It really depends. Like the Rolling Stones, like their Satanic Majesty's Request is better in mono because the mix is totally different. But like, I don't know, Sgt. Pepper's probably better in stereo. Although I've never had the mono mix of that.
Yeah, it's actually included in the box set as well. It's a new mono mix, like a remastered mono mix, and there's the new remastered stereo mix. It's a four disc. It's a four disc thing.
I got the two disc version, and that has a new stereo mix that was built up from the mono mix. The point being is they wanted to give you the differences in the mono version, but across stereo. But to me, they separated everything so much it made it an interesting academic, prospect, but less enjoyable for listening.
Hmm.
Well, now you guys can find out. Here you go. Here's for the benefit of Mr. Kite, mono.
I played accordion on that for a performance. It was pretty fucking awesome.
Oh, I guess we don't have the rights to that. All right. So anyways, yeah. So a bunch of Jawbreaker stuff got jacked. So you can do that. I mean, the reason why I was trying to figure out how serious this was is because if you look at their statement, the last sentence in their statement is like, you know, basically like all this shit was stolen, .. You can buy a ticket to our show at Amoeba Hollywood for $3. And it's like, oh, okay. So like no one seemed like they were too super destroyed about it. But I mean, you know, I'm always curious about like when a bunch of this like vintage gear gets taken, because I don't know how much of this stuff is actually out there in the wild, but you would expect that it's like, especially amongst musicians and things like that, you're going to know if, you know, some.
Yeah, those snare drums.
The 1966 Ludwig maple snare. Are those just floating around? Can you just get one of those at the fucking Goodwill?
So, like the 1989 Yamaha snare, like, you know, like snare technology, snare drum technology, like since the 80s, there hasn't been that many, you know, it's a drum, but a 60s Ludwig, you're going to know. I mean, you're talking like Ringo era Ludwig drums. Ringo played Ludwig, back to the Beatles. Those are some expensive ass snare drums.
Do you think the thieves knew what they were getting, Greg, or do you think they would just break into the shit and they're like, we'll just sell it?
I think they're just like, we'll grab whatever.
You think it was an inside job?
meaning what? Like,
it was an inside job.
What if it was one of those Storage Wars shows where it's just they bust open, there's a bunch of cameras, they're like, look at all this stuff, and they take it and pawn it, and it ends up on TV. And
except there's like a bunch of needless drama. Like, Jim thinks it's worth $450, but I know it's only worth $375. This is going to cost us big time.
Are those shows still around? I'm dating myself to when we got rid of cable.
But my dad watches those all the time. My dad watches Pickers. Oh my god, that show is brutal.
Okay, hey guys, for you might not be as interested in this as I am, but I'm Facebook friends with Mike Felumley, and he for reference, like how much one of these snare drums might go for, especially if the thieves were able to say it was played, you know, on Jawbreaker albums. Mike Felumley is selling the snare drum that he played on From Here to Infirmary, the Alkaline Trio album. He's selling this. It's a pork pie snare, which is a good custom brand, but it's just like it was made, you know, late 90s. You know, he played it on this record and some other stuff. And like the Facebook thread is just like crazy. Like this is going to go for like probably $3,000 minimum. And it's a late 90s snare that he played on an Alkaline Trio album. You know, cool album. But if the thieves can be like, these snares are not only vintage, awesome snare drums, but they were on these Jawbreaker tours and Jawbreaker records, like they could get a fuck ton of money.
Wait. Greg, well, a couple things. But you were saying that Mike Felumley is suddenly selling equipment he's had for a while. At the same time, Jawbreaker announces their stuff's been stolen. secondly, there is a market for, you know, illegal historic artifacts that they know the importance of, and there is a market for illegal stolen art. Like, is there a market? Like, is there some rich guy out there that's willing to buy illegal stuff stolen from Jawbreaker just so he can have it personally?
Well, he's in jail for securities fraud right now. So. Oh, our buddy, we miss you. Get out soon. All right, John, you want this next story here?
Sure, what is it? Just give me the title.
The PRB one.
Oh, yeah. Punk Rock Bowling has announced their latest club show. Radioactive is playing. A lot of people are excited by Radioactive. Punk News is a Punk Rock Bowling sponsor. We'll have a whole bunch of Punk Rock Bowling content at Punk News. I was surprised. People were freaking out of this. This is cool. I'm much more excited maybe to see Old Firm Casuals. That is a cool band. I'm really excited to see Steve Ignorant at Punk Rock Bowling. But people were excited about this, and I got to say, the Punk Rock Bowling club shows are always very well curated, if you will. Last year I saw Dwarves and Blank 77 and a band called The Wildlife, which was really cool. The year before that was World Inferno and Morning Glory. The Punk Rock Bowling club shows are always very well put together, and that it's an interesting, diverse bill. And if you go, you're probably going to be a fan or semi-fan of every band on the bill, this one included.
Yeah, I love Radioactivity. I mean, like, I love everything that Jeff Burke, you know, is involved in. And so I was actually a little bit surprised to see them associated with this in a way, because there always feels like there's been some like weird membrane between like these like cool Portland and Denton Dirt Nap Records garage bands and like the rest of the punk world, and like maybe they'd be too cool to go play like, you know, a show that has the fucking Mighty Mighty Boss Tones on the bill. But hey, good for them. I mean, I saw Radioactivity in Toronto last year, the year before that. Although now I'm blanking if it was actually Radioactivity or the Markman. It must have been Radioactivity. And it was super great. That guy is awesome. So you know, this is cool. If you're in the area and looking for a club show to go to, this is one that you should go to. Yeah. I don't know. We don't have too much to say about this. It's a show. It's happening. But Radioactivity is cool. You should go listen to them. All right. So I'll do one more story before we take a little break here. This past week was on Tuesday, on the 16th of January, Peter Eichhorn of the German punk label P-Trash Records was killed in a car accident, died from injuries that he sustained in the car accident. I'm not exactly sure of the time frame of that. Peter's wife, Suzanne, who runs P-Trash with him, basically said that, like, with his death, the label's done as well. They're going to take some time to mourn, and they're going to, you know, wind down their business and get all their accounts settled. And that's it. That's done for P-Trash. And P-Trash, from my weird little perspective, has been an incredibly influential record, not just in my world, but for some strange reason, in the general Canadian music scene, P-Trash has been incredibly important. And I don't even know how that connection was fully made, but they, you know, probably about 10 years ago or so, they started releasing just tons of records for tiny bands from bands from Montreal, tons of bands from Ottawa, bands from Vancouver, really just like mining these scenes for everything that was like cool and weird that was going on there, and giving all these bands that had like no profile at home here, let alone like no international profile, like European releases and getting them sort of out into the wider world there. And so like they were big for like getting the first few records from like the Steve Adamic band noticed. I mean, the biggest band that I can think of that was probably on P-Trash would have been like Jay Retard. Like, he released a bunch of stuff for him. But then like I'm just going through the list of like stuff that he's been involved in. And just like Demon's Claws, which was or a lot of bands out of Montreal that were like the Mark Salton barbecue kind of related bands were out there. But he released stuff from Brutal Knights and Statues and Zebra Sears out of Ottawa, Average Times. They were the European distributor for bands like New Swears and the White Wires and Crusades. And like they did so much for so many bands in this country, being just like a German label. And I'm still like a little bit baffled about how important P-Trash became to like so many scenes up here. But it often felt like that guy knew more what was going on in our backyards than we knew what was going on in our backyards. So like super tragic, you know, for him to have to lose his life. Like he had kids and everything like that, and his wife survives him. And, you know, it's sad that the label's going away, but it makes sense. It was his baby and everything. But yeah, so it's quite a loss, because he was just doing a ton of good work, for some bewildering reason, really, really helping out Canada. But man, P-Trash released so much stuff, and they were like, in my head, they were always like do you guys remember like what like No Idea was like in like the late 90s, mm-hmm. early 2000s?
Oh yeah.
How it was like a mail order label for the most part. And you would get like with anything you ordered from them, you just get this like long sheet of these are the next like 45 releases that we have coming out, and they'd be like distributing things. Like, you weren't even really sure. Sometimes it was just stuff that was on the label or something that they were just helping other people release. And P-Trash was a lot like that, from the standpoint of this scene. And they feel like a lot like that these days. Like, even everything they were doing online was like super low tech, and like, it felt very 90s about it. But you know, they were, you know, if you want to talk about like people that were able to like help create scenes and like the effort of like a few individuals really making punk rock happen in the world. So, you know, what Peter was doing with P-Trash was definitely, you know, a great example of that. So anywho, I'm going to play a song from a band that had a release out on P-Trash. So there was at one point in time a band called Teledrome that was out of Calgary. They were kind of like a synth punk band. They had a record that came out that was called, what was the Teledrome record came out? Was it self-titled? I'm blanking on it. It was called Teledrome. So I'm going to play a song from that. It's called Dial Tone. It came out in 2014 on Upbound P-Trash in Europe. So here you go. All right, we're back. That was Teledrome, now defunct synth punk band out of Calgary. John, tell the people about Magic Bullet.
All right, well, this is turning out to be a long podcast. I thought it was going to be a short one. So I'll just mention this briefly. Magic Bullet has been a record label for about 20 years now. Actually, they have been a record label for 20 years. They've put out some groundbreaking, some controversial releases. They've put out some important integrity records. They've put out a lot of bands that I'm not necessarily a fan of, but have a very dedicated following. Bands like Page 99 and that kind of genre. They've also put out Charles Manson records, which have rankled a lot of people in a lot of different ways. The Magic Bullet also famously put out a couple of Zex records, or at least one Zex record. And Adam, as you may recall, the guy from Zex threatened to sue Magic Bullet, or did actually sue Magic Bullet. It wasn't clear. It seemed to me he hadn't actually sued them and was just threatening to do so after Magic Bullet, quote, dropped them from the label or refused to work with them further after certain allegations were alleged against the guitarist, the fellow from the band. What was his name?
Like, a lawsuit ever really happened there, but
It's my guess that it didn't, but I don't know, you know. So anyways, now after 20 years, the label has either ceased to be or has morphed into a new thing called Dark Operative Records. And so some of the bands have about six or seven bands have come through, including Integrity, Black Mare, and a couple of other groups. This caught a lot of people by surprise. Was this just because, you know, he wanted to trim down the Brent Einstein who is Magic Bullet Records? Was it just because he wanted to trim down and kind of, you know, rejuice and, you know, come back swinging hard? Or was this because of, you know, the Manson thing, because of the Zex thing? Did he want to distance himself from that and start anew? Nobody knows. But we'll just have to see, is the change cosmetic or is it a change to the core?
Yeah, I mean, we'll just leave it with that. I don't have anything to add to the Magic Bullet story there. It's I don't know if you can just change the name of a label and get away from the
liability
things that you've done. Well, not I mean, you might be able to get away from the monetary liabilities if you stage your bankruptcy properly. But I mean, the reputational liabilities probably make more of an impact in the punk scene. So.
One thing is, I always remember is about 7 or 8 years ago, Pung News did an interview with Brent, and I know Brent. I'm not friends with Brent, but I'm on friendly terms with him. And about 7 years, it wasn't me. Someone interviewed him, and Brent started talking trash on Suburban Home Records, and everyone's like, "Man, Brent's a dick. Like, why is he talking trash on Suburban Home? Everybody loves Suburban Home." And then it turned out like no one was getting paid on Suburban Home, and the label went belly up. You know, so he was right. He was right. Like, you know, he was calling it like it is. You know. I always remember.
Yeah. So, I don't know. We don't have anything else about to go with that one. That's what's happening. Greg, let's for a brief moment here before we wrap up the last few stories we have to do. We're talking about Hot Snakes.
Yes.
Hot Snakes released a new song. It is called Six Wave Hold Down. It's from the album they have coming out on Sub Pop in when? In...
We didn't in say
2018.
That. Yeah, we didn't say it in the story.
called Jericho Sirens. This is going to be what, the fourth Hot Snakes record?
Yeah,
the fourth. I mean, if you don't count that BBC Peel Sessions thing, we're going to say fourth.
Yeah.
And you can go listen to it. And it sounds like Hot Snakes.
Oh,
what'd you think?
Oh, March 16th. Okay. Boom. Yeah, I'm just looking at this email I got from Sub Pop. The song is awesome, and even the video is perfect. Like, you know how Hot Snakes, the visual aesthetic of their artwork and stuff like that. Yeah, you know, I can you explain it, Adam? You know what I'm talking about? Like the continuity through the artwork of their albums and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, there is a. I'm not a design person, so I couldn't tell you what particular school or anything like that it's from, but you know that. Shit, what's his name there? John, Swami there.
Oh, John Reese.
So John like, Reese.
Yeah. So he's had a lot of a hand in I think the visual approach to this group, and it is all very I'm babbling about this. It is all very consistent and has remained sort of like very pure to the same kind of like I'm not even gonna try to define it. I want to say something where I have like no grounds to do it. And so like, oh, it's from like the Bauhaus school. And I was like, well, I don't actually know if that's true.
See, that's why that's why I was throwing it to you. I'm like, all I know is I really like their artwork in this video. Just like, it's got the info and the Sub Pop over the UPC. And then the 45 is spinning in the video. And I'm just like, this is so Hot Snakes. I'm like, they're fucking back. I'm so happy. And I can't believe John doesn't, why don't you like them, John? This seems like a kind of band you would like.
I don't hate him on. I don't hate Hot Snakes. Like I'm trashing Hot Snakes. I think they're fine. It's just a little too retro for me, but nothing new in the retroness. It's too much tribute, not enough individuality.
Okay, I want you to listen to. Okay, so Suicide Invoice is my favorite album of theirs. If you listen to the song LAX and the song Paid in Cigarettes, something about like me trying to figure out these songs on guitar, like just for fun one time, made me realize that there's really a lot more going on. Like the chord shapes and stuff. They're not just playing a bunch of like open chords or bar chords that, you know, any other garage band would. Like there's a lot more to it. And there's like odd time signatures that are so sneaky. It's like, it's not like Rush where it's like, oh, look, we're going from 9/8 to 4/4 to 6/8 to whatever. It's like, they're very sneaky about it. The songs are, they're complex without, while still having that beating you over the head rock and roll kind of thing to it. I really think you should give them another shake.
I'll give them a spin, sure. I mean, anybody that has off progeny in them, I'm willing to give the benefit of the doubt. So,
all right.
So anyways, everyone should be excited that there is new Hot Snakes record coming out. If there's anything that is going to save us from this fucking shithole of a universe we live in, it's that. John, talk about why people are mad at you briefly.
People are always mad at me. Honestly, people are mad at me because they want every single song to be some bearded loser in flannel singing about how whiskey and friendship are going to make him get through the weekend so he can hate the next 5 days and then get together with his friends on a Friday night and look at the sun come up while drinking whiskey and PBR and saying, even though my life's shitty due to my own choices and my inability to try to change things for a better direction, we'll be friends.
Pick it up here. Come on.
Listen, the garden... The Garden is an amazing band. This is like their fifth album, but I guess you could say their third proper album. The Garden is two brothers, Fletcher and Wyatt Shears. They make very unusual, very awesome, very interesting punk rock. I believe it's Fletcher plays the drums and Wyatt plays the guitar, although I might have that switched. Their first album was, well, not the first album, their first album proper, I guess you could say. Their first big album was Life and Times of a Paperclip. It was very much like Wire's Pink Flag in that it's very simple, very short, very weird. Perspective. Their second album was called Ha Ha, which I did not like at first, but then after a click, it became one of my favorite albums of the past 10 years, maybe one of my top 10 albums of the past 10 years. It was the bass and drums, I mean, guitar and drum simplicity, but they had a lot of computers in them. After that, they put out an EP called You Want the Scoop, which was all electronic, and I thought that's how they were headed, but now they've announced a new album. The new album is called Mirror Might Steal Your Charm, and they put out their first single, and the first single actually didn't have any electronics in it at all. It was almost kind of like a college rock sound with guitar and drums and some other things added in. The video was pretty interesting. It's got a kind of a guy in a Joker motif, not Joker the Batman, the old Joker the card, driving around with a dog. And what's interesting, if you follow The Garden, it's very interesting because they, much like Salvador Dali, they repeat certain motifs throughout the body of their work. And it's not always clear what the meaning of that motif is, but there does appear to be a meaning there. I'm not sure what the meaning of this motif is, but it's very unusual, very surreal, and very interesting. This track, I dug it. It didn't blow me away, but neither did the tracks from Ha Ha when I first heard them. And then when I heard them together, I'm like, holy crap, this is genius, or not, if not genius, then very close to that. The new album, I'm very excited. They change a lot with on every record, like they have phases, which is very interesting. And that's, as a fan, that's kind of exactly what you want a band to be. They don't do the same thing over and over and over, but at their core, there's still that same weird spontaneity and alienness that I don't quite understand. And half the fun is me trying to figure out if I can understand what they're trying to do.
Is this the only band that you like on Epitaph's current lineup? I'm surprised that you like an Epitaph band.
Well, I don't care about labels at all. I mean, the label means almost nothing to me, except for I love Alternative Tentacles. I love Burger. Although these guys were actually on Burger before Epitaph.
Really? That's an interesting jump.
And actually, I'm the guy to first do an interview with this band and to first review this band. I was on the ground floor, baby.
Look at him now getting trashed in the comments section. Their photo is pretty douchey. I'm just gonna tell you that.
This is how small-minded the punk rock community is. Punk rock community is, you should be individual and you shouldn't judge people by their looks. These guys are choosing a unique, weird look, and people are like, this is stupid. But if there were some bearded losers in flannel, people wouldn't say, oh, this is great. You know what I mean? It's like how small the punk community is, so small-minded in that. Everything like they say they're against, they actually are. They don't see it. You know what I mean? And people say, oh, these guys are douchey. Like, honestly, like, I've talked to these guys a whole bunch of times. I've interviewed them like three times. They're nice kids. They're nice people. They don't deserve, like, people. I think people think they're douches or they're jerks because they're tall and handsome fellows, but they're nice guys, and actually they're probably nerdier than people think, you know, and it's just people being shallow. It's like, that guy's handsome, he must be an asshole, but they're not. They're very nice people.
Right. Yeah, I'm not speaking ill will of the band, and I didn't get a chance to check this out because I feel like it was not on the notes before I signed on to Skype. I don't know. But the picture...
You might actually like it.
Yeah, sure. I'm just saying, like, the guy on the left is like, it's time to bring... middle parts back. I'm going to start parting my hair down the middle again and wearing chains. It makes me think of middle school. I'm just okay. So he's bringing sexy back is what you're saying.
I'm not saying that. I'm saying they're weird, unique guys that dress weirdly and uniquely because they make weird, unique music.
Sure. Yeah. I'll listen to it. I'm intrigued to see how all those like chain chokers make him sing.
John, to your credit, John, I listened to this, and as I listened to it, I didn't look at their picture or watch their video, and I thought to myself, you know what, truthfully, if I was to come across this and you were to tell me that the band is from fucking Moose Jaw, I'd have been like, all right, I'm into this, so it's all right, it's cool, I'm down.
There you go.
Now, I want to correct something that I babbled at earlier, because I'm going to get angry mail from, I don't know, maybe someone. All of Hot Snake's art and their aesthetic and the Swami aesthetic, uh-huh. for that matter, is all Rick Froberg, the singer, guitarist for Hot Snakes. So it's him. Like, he is like a visual artist by trade. Like, that's his thing. I did not mean to attribute all of that to John Rice. So I'm sorry, Rick Froberg. I love you. Don't hurt me.
Good stuff.
All right. So we have to end on a downer. So the, came out just to, was it today or yesterday? Just earlier today.
About five hours.
I mean, we don't post these things for like 7 weeks after, so it'll be old news. But the news came out that, Mark E. Smith, the frontman of The Fall, passed away at age 60. The cause of death has not officially been released, at least at the time when we're talking about this, but he's been ill for some time. He passed away at his home. His family stated they'd reveal more details in the next few days. He had to cancel some dates recently due to, quote, rare medical issues, unquote. But that's all everyone knows right now. But everyone's sort of been reminiscing about The Fall. Mark E. Smith, really, like, I want to say, like, infamously difficult as an individual, as a bandmate. Like, there is, what, something like 40 different people that have been in The Fall,
yeah,
at some point, because he would like fire them every record. Like, they had like how many full lengths did The Fall release? It was like
over 30, like a lot.
It was like 32 or something. Yeah, like it was like they released an incredible amount of stuff. The sound of these records is all over the place, mainly because, I mean, he was a chameleon himself, but they kept firing all the band members, right? So that's going to change up the way your band sounds. You know, on the one hand, you know, they released some shit that was incredibly influential. I was listening to a bunch of like, just like some greatest hit stuff today. And it's nuts how many of the bands that I'm into these days, like, have like direct, you could draw direct lines between their sound and between this sort of like wiry pop sound that was just sort of like emergent post-punk that The Fall was doing, you know, right out of the punk era. And, you know, and we cannot also deny that like this dude had his problems. He had his controversies. Like, he was, you know, in the 90s or so, he was arrested for assaulting his
wife,
girlfriend, and bandmate.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, he was not a saint, and he was not an easy person, but he was an influential one and put out a shit ton of music. So The Fall is pretty much done with the demise of Mark E. Smith, and they have left a legacy that I have found personally impenetrably terrifying. So they're one of these bands where I need to go disappear for a month from society to like really come to grips with everything that they've released.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, so that is kind of the sad news that we wanted to end on here. What are we doing to wrap this up? Are we?
I'm playing a song. How about that?
Play something to make people not sad.
Okay.
Or conflicted.
Well, okay. So They Might Be Giants are my favorite band ever, if you made me pick. And yes, I know, John, we've talked about them a bit and how amazing they are. A lot of people say that their first few records, the first four that were done as the duo, are their best stuff, and I love those. I love those records, but I love everything they put out. They just put out a new album called I Like Fun. I haven't given it enough spins yet to pick one of those tracks, but since I'm seeing them live in Indianapolis in exactly 2 weeks, I've been listening to nothing but They Might Be Giants, just making huge playlists. John, if you want to go check out my Spotify playlist, Best of They Might Be Giants, for stuff you've missed. I'm going to play one, I guess you'd call kind of a deep cut, because it's right like mid-catalog. I guess you'd call it a newer album because it's from 2007. The album is called The Else, and it was co-produced with the Dust Brothers, who've done stuff with, like, I think Beck and stuff like that.
Beastie Boys, Paul Boutique.
There, yep, There you go. Okay, I knew I was missing something important. So it's got this album has an interesting kind of twist on it, but it also has that the They Might Be Giants sound, which is that they don't really have a sound and they do whatever the fuck they want, any genre they want. So the song I've been most addicted to right now, track four on that, is called Climbing the Walls. And even though it's not a happy song, it's one of those songs that They Might Be Giants do so well, where it's an incredibly catchy song that will pep you up, but then if you delve into the lyrics, you're like, this is really a very kind of dark song. So this is They Might Be Giants, sort of classic track, Climbing the Walls, off of their 2007 album, The Else.
I can't talk, I gotta go, don't call me back, I won't get the door. Got to focus on the job, cause I got a new job, climbing the walls. I was grinding my teeth, I was wasting my youth, and using up my teeth. Now I'm done, chewing my nails, hanging my head, chasing my tail. It got so bad, junk. Can we please clear out this house? In the trunk, in the trunk, and then we'll take it all to the dump. Then we won't need the car, cause we'll stay where we are, and I'll have all this room. I got tired of pacing the floor, sick of it all, I'm done with the floor.
That about wraps it up for this week. Podcast at punknews.org is how you can yell at us. And I don't know. Anything else? Anything to say? We done?
Done.
Done.
This has been a Velour Underground production. I am Greg Simpson, producer of this podcast. Hit me up if you want me to mix, master, or produce your podcast, even from afar. Or, you got a band you want to come record with me in scenic Lafayette, Indiana? Let's do it. Hit me up at greg@velourundergroundstudios.com.